Earners, what's up? Y'all know the adage, buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/earn. That's fundrise.com/earn. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Earners, what's up? Look, if creating content is more than just a passion project for you, it's time to make the passion profitable. With Kajabi, you can easily diversify your revenue, build your brand, and transform your audience into loyal customers. I know firsthand how challenging it can be to juggle content creation and business development, but Kajabi makes it easy to streamline everything in one place. As a creator, you are your brand, so your business should reflect exactly what you envision. With Kajabi, not only can you build your business your way, but you can also keep every cent of what you earn. It's an all-in-one platform that lets you focus on what matters most, your content and your audience. And let's face it, we all need a little help sometimes, especially when you're a one-person show. But you don't need to hire a full-time team. You just need Kajabi. Kajabi is a leading all-in-one platform that helps creators and entrepreneurs build successful online businesses by unlocking predictable, recurring revenue. Whether you're a coach, content creator, or educator, Kajabi makes it easy to transform your skills, passions, and experiences into enriching online courses, exclusive membership sites, subscription podcasts, and more. The best part? Kajabi doesn't take a cut of your revenue. Everything you create is owned and controlled by you, so you keep 100% of what you earn. On top of that, Kajabi gives you robust analytics, easy payment options, email marketing tools, and customizable website templates, everything you need to grow your business seamlessly. And here's the thing, you don't need a massive audience to make sustainable income. Thousands of creators are making six and seven figures with Kajabi, even with less than 50,000 followers. So if you're navigating the challenges of generating revenue as a creator, Kajabi can be the game changer you need. Right now, Kajabi is offering an incredible deal, a free 30-day trial to help you kickstart your business. Just head over to kajabi.com/earn to get started. That's kajabi.com/earn. Join the creators and entrepreneurs who've made over $7 billion on their platforms and take control of your financial future with Kajabi today. Kajabi.com/earn. Don't miss out on this opportunity to turn your passion into profit.
Earners, what's going on? Listen, EYLU is relaunching, revamping, retooling. That's right, we're creating a new educational experience that's more expansive. Shadi, tell me what we got.
Yes, 2023. We got a lot in store, a lot planned for you guys. So you know that EYLU already includes monthly financial planning calls with me, book club calls with Troy, real estate calls with MG the Mortgage Guy, access to the Home Buying Blueprint, Volume 1 and Volume 2. Part of the revamp will include 27 local chapters from across the United States, live interactive teaching, hands-on, not just pre-recorded videos, plus 15 brand new curriculums.
The biggest just got bigger.
Head over to EYLUniversity.com. That's EYLUniversity.com. See you there.
All right, guys. Welcome back. EYL. So this is my international episode of sorts, even though we're home. So Dean Forbes is somebody that we actually met when we were in London. Mm-hmm. We interviewed him for the Market Monday. So we did a Market Mondays World Tour. If you wasn't familiar with it, pretty legendary situation. We did Toronto, London, Ghana, Chicago, and LA. And each stop, we interviewed a local person from that area that was doing things on a very high level. And we've been to London a few times. We had Royal Albert Hall situation.
Legendary.
The first time was sure. Tape London. Shout out to Tape. We did a few things in London that was crazy. So this time we wanted to actually interview somebody that was local, but like on the highest level possible. And I forgot who the first person that had suggested you. It might have been Dio. maybe. Not sure. It was somebody. But they were saying that you were like a real success story coming from the neighborhood and then working your way up to, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you are the top black CEO in the UK, right?
Probably.
We're going to say that. No, we're saying that.
Some would say.
Some would say. Yeah, your name came up not just one time, a few times when we were trying to figure out who's the person. It was kind of a consensus of amongst the people. Like,
that's nice.
You're the person.
Yeah. That's nice.
You led 17 acquisitions, achieved a $1 billion deal. You've doubled companies' valuations. You've been a leader in the tech industry, reinvented yourself multiple times. And you still have done it with a strong commitment and uplifting the community and keeping true to your original roots. So we did the interview live, and it was really dope. Everybody that was there enjoyed it. But, you know, that's a intimate experience. So everybody doesn't actually get to, you know, experience that unless you was actually at the Market Mondays World Tour. So wanted to do something that was a little bit more expansive, that could reach a wider audience as opposed to just the people that was actually there, to share your story and provide the insight because it's important, and to show love to our UK following because we got a lot of followers in the UK, and we haven't done an episode with somebody from the UK in a while. It's been probably over 2 years.
And I think his story encompasses everything that we've been built on, right? When we had the aspiration, it was like, yes, sports entertainment is cool. And I know that's the background, but there's so many other ways to become successful. And I feel like your life is really the Earn Your Leisure story, right? Sports entertainment to business, how we transition. So it's gonna be an amazing story to inspire more people.
So first and foremost, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, man. Good to be back. Good
and he's sharp, man. Look at his blazer.
For sure, always.
Custom blazer. Always.
So you're on this side of the pond.
Yeah.
So welcome to America.
Thank you.
Yeah, so all right, let's get into it. Tell us the story. For people that are not familiar with you, from, like I said, starting humble beginnings, sports, then you get into business and you just kind of just take off. So kind of walk us through your journey.
Yeah. Well, like I said, good to be back. I had a lot of fun at Market Mondays. The energy you guys bring is unbelievable. But I mean, yeah, the story is, I guess, like a lot of us. I grew up on what we call council estate. In the UK,
what's it called?
We call it a council estate here. You call it a housing project.
Right? Okay, so, government assistance.
Yeah, government assistance.
Okay,
yeah, in the big blocks, and like most people who grew up in those environments, the number one way out for people that look like us, or the kind of most frequent way out, is either sports, entertainment, or some of the unsavory things.
Top boy.
Right. Yeah. top
the boy. Street pharmacist, right?
Exactly. And that was never really an option. Although, like a lot of people, you kind of saw it and you flirted with it, but when you had a mother like mine, it was, you know, the fear of dealing with her was more, you were more scared of that than going into a correctional facility, for sure. Yeah. So never really got into that. I played football, which you guys call soccer, but it's really football. I played football a lot, and yeah, that was supposed to be my path. I was signed to a team at Crystal Palace for a long time, and when it came to being serious, you know, the point at which you really become a professional and really double down, I came out of the game. I didn't get my contract, wasn't renewed. And along that journey to trying to become a footballer, my mum lost her home, or we lost the home that we lived in. So we were homeless for a short while. Then the football career ended. Then we were homeless again. And the way, you know, the fastest way for the family to be housed was to break the family up, because the government could find smaller properties faster than they could find, you know, larger properties.
How many people's in your family?
Four. So my mum and my two brothers. So four of us. So
now, mom is from West Jamaica?
My mum's Guyanese and my dad's Jamaican.
Okay,
yes,
gotcha.
Yeah, so, you know, that was the second time I was homeless. Kind of football crashed, and I had a lot of debt at the time, you know, because in pursuing the football career, I had a lot of friends who were doing really, really well at football, and they were earning real money from football at like 18, 19. So in order to keep up with them, keep up appearances with them on the nights out and, you know, with girls and stuff around, I was borrowing money, right? So I was spending money on credit cards and borrowing money to keep up that appearance. So when I came out of the game and lost the house, I had like £89,000 of debt.
£89,000 of debt?
Yeah, at 18.
At 18?
Yeah.
His credit card debt?
Overdraft and credit card debt. Yeah.
That's a lot of parties, man.
Yeah, I mean, and I had a car too. I mean, I really, you know, really went for it, because that was the environment. It was like I had most of my friends were doing really well at football, and I was one of very few in that group who financially wasn't. Like, I was signed to a team, but not in the way that that they were. So when I fell out the game, my agent at the time, he said, look, you know, we've been trying to get you a new deal. There are clubs who will give you a short-term deal for good money, but then if that doesn't work out, what are we going to do? There are clubs that will give you a longer-term deal, but not for good money. You got to go to work. So that's what I did. I went to work at Motorola, making cold calls, and that was the beginning.
So yeah, at Motorola. Are you still homeless at this point?
At that point, so I lived in a hostel for a period, which is like
it's like a motel.
Yeah, like a bad, like a
yeah. Like an inn, a motor inn.
It's like what would you call that? Like a dormitory, right? So you live in a, you know, big room. There's like 12 beds. There's Eastern Europeans, Turkish people, like people from all kinds of ethnicities with their families and their bags, and you just, yeah, you stay there until
like
until,
a shelter.
Until you get, yeah, yeah, like shelter, shelter. I guess.
Yeah, it's like a shelter. Cool.
And then I met my now wife. So at the point of going to Motorola, I lived with her. She had a one-bedroom apartment, and she kind of let me stay there at the beginning. So that was my route out of being homeless to live with her.
So all right, so you meet your now wife, you get into a one-bedroom apartment, you're making cold calls for Motorola, you're selling something, you're selling services.
I'm trying to book appointments for field sales reps. So I'm calling companies and saying, can I send a guy in to spend time with you and talk to you about Motorola products and services?
Okay. And I'm assuming you do pretty well. You work your way up the ladder, become like one of the top sales people, right?
Yeah, yeah. Not at the beginning, because the transition out of playing football to making cold calls was like the coldest shower you could imagine. But yeah, over time, I managed to kind of figure it out and became a leader there.
So how do you get into, what's your journey to become an entrepreneur?
So I came out of Motorola and went to a US-based software company that was trying to grow internationally. So I went to the London office that had just been opened. There were like six people. There were a couple hundred people in Philly, but there were like six people in this London office. So I was one of the first in that office in a sales role. So as I kind of got better at making sales, was making quota, people were leaving, I would say to the owners, you know, don't replace that person. Just give me their territory. Don't replace that person who just left. Give me their territory. So I kind of outstayed a couple generations of salespeople, had most of the territory, and convinced them to let me kind of look after that part of the business as almost like a franchise, right? So I would run international. They would take care of the US. And in return, they would give me equity in the entire company. So that's kind of how I came out of being at Motorola into understanding what equity meant. And we grew that company over the 9 years I was there and sold it to Oracle for $550 million. So my kind of journey into entrepreneurialism and you know, liquidating equity was because I landed in this American company that was trying to grow internationally.
So you watched them sell. So I'm there's six of y'all, and as people keep getting let off, you're taking on their role, right? Until now you're the international guys. And you're watching this sale about to happen and realizing like, there's two sides of the scale. Like, what is the inspiration after that?
It was a little bit different. So after people left and I was kind of the lone guy, we built a team. So we built that team to about 150 people. Okay. Out of London, Germany, India, Japan, China. So I was responsible for that international expansion. So we opened offices in all those places. And by the time we were selling, I was the SVP of international. And I was part of the team that, you know, did that deal, right, alongside the CEO. So I was right in the seat. So I got to watch the deal. I got to participate in the deal. I knew what my equity was worth. As time had gone on, I'd been given and bought more equity. So I was part of that. And that changed mine and my family's, you know, life in a material way.
So after that sale, now you're full-fledged, you're in the mergers and acquisition game.
Right.
Right. So what happens next after that?
So along the way, I got calls from different private equity firms, different venture capital firms saying, hey, you know, we see the job you're doing. We see how well it's going. We hear all the stories. Do you want to come and run this software company that we just invested in? So I'd become a little bit known to the investment community. So when the deal got done with Oracle, I had a lot of calls, but I had a tie-in with Oracle. And as soon as the tie-in ended, it's pretty lucky, like I had a good set of offers. So I chose to go and run a Paris headquartered software company with Accel VC. And because my situation at Oracle was so strong, both in terms of equity that I'd had, the tie-in that I had as part of the deal I was able to negotiate to go and be CEO there was probably for a level of equity you wouldn't normally see in a VC type deal with an external non-founder CEO. So that kind of set me, you know, set me up as a first time CEO as well.
So can you talk about, I mean, whatever, however much you can talk about, can you kind of talk about what that looked like as far as your negotiation and what you were able to kind of frame for yourself?
So over time at Primavera, I came.
And that's the new company.
No, that's the company we sold to Oracle. So over time at Primavera, I probably got to just under 3% of equity through a stock option vehicle. Then through the tie-in was, a multi seven figure tie-in at Oracle. And the longer you stayed, it kind of grew over time. So after I got through kind of the mandatory period of the tie-in and I had the option to go be CEO, I was able to go to them and say, you know, market rate for a CEO in venture capital might be 4% to 6% equity, but I'm going to need more than that because of the situation I'm walking away from. And the fact that this is what we call a transformational situation, like the company I was going to be CEO of wasn't performing well. It was a very difficult situation. So the combination of the economics I was walking away from, what I'd had at Primavera meant when they were saying this is a 4 to 6%, I was able to say, you know, it's going to need to be more than that. It wasn't quite double digit percentage, but it was more than market.
Which is incredible. It's the Larry Ellison Oracle, correct?
Oracle, exactly.
So exactly. There's a common theme here. You got Prime Vista.
Primavera. And then KDS.
All in technology. Was that part of the blueprint for you? Like, these are the fastest growing companies. I want to be in this sector. Like, how did you approach this?
Well, I fell into Primavera. Then we sold Primavera to Oracle. And Oracle at the time was the number one technology company on earth. So now I'm in a 40,000 person, publicly listed, one of the biggest technology companies on earth. I just learned. Like, I just watched everything. I watched Charles Phillips. I watched Safra Catz. I watched all the execs. I sat in meetings I wasn't supposed to be in. Like, I just really, really soaked it up. So at Primavera, I didn't really understand the velocity of tech, the value creation that happens in tech. I was just doing pretty much my first meaningful job. At Oracle, like, it blew my mind what was happening. And as part of the transaction, Oracle gave hundreds of people in Primavera, stock options. And that's what really opened my mind to the value that can be realized through equity, even as an employee, which I was at the time. So that when I understood that and I went to KDS and then to CoreHR and then to Access and now at Fortero, that lesson from Oracle of what value can truly be created through M&A, accelerating organic growth, add-on upsells, like that really opened my mind. So from there, it was so clear to me what trajectory you could create if you could really find a niche, if you could really find good product market fit, if you could get sales engine moving, what kind of value that you could create in tech.
So, okay. So you're able to scale that up as well, right? So at what point do you really like hit your stride and become like a superstar in the space, do you think?
Well, not yet. what became important to me was to try to prove that the good things that were happening weren't environmental. Right? That became important to me. So I kind of said, okay, Primavera was a good company, had momentum, US based, and I kind of found my way there. So now at KDS, this company's not going well. Primavera was going well when I arrived. This company's not going well. Can I turn that company around? Okay. So that was that situation. I want to find another situation that doesn't look like either of these two. And I want to deliver in that situation because now I've got three successes, different types of technology, different geographic markets, different types of end customers. And if I can do three, then that probably answers a question that it's not environmental. It's not that I find, I'm lucky in showing up in good places. So that became important to me. And I would say after the third one, which was Core HR, which we sold to Access for 250 million euros. After that one, I started to feel like I might know what I'm doing. It was like at that point I thought,
let me ask you this, follow up. How did you turn, let's talk about this, the second company, right, that you went to, you became a CEO, you turned it around,
mm-hmm.
and you ended up selling it?
We sold it to American Express for 125.
So how did you turn it around, and what was the process of actually selling the company to American Express?
That company was a Paris-headquartered SaaS business that had 95% of its customers in France. So the play there was geographic expansion. So we grew that company in the UK, Germany, and the US. So what I learned at Motorola in sales, Primavera in sales, and Oracle in sales was pretty much the sharp end of how we grew KDS. It was a sales play, a go-to-market play. So it was really kind of optimizing sales and marketing in new geographies. A little bit of what I'd done at Primavera. And we created a partnership with American Express where they were relying on our technology for a white label arrangement to service their customers. And as a result of that, they were kind of automating, you know, a big part of their business meant they didn't need people to do a bunch of stuff. They were using the technology to do it. So when we knew we wanted to sell the company, we went to American Express and said, we have a partnership. This is delivering a lot of value for you. You probably should think about buying the company. And they kind of said, you know, partnership works. Why would we buy the company if, you know, we can just pay you to white label it? So then I went to MasterCard and said, we're delivering a service to American Express. You probably ought to have the same service. We know you have some relationships, but they're not delivering for you in the same way as we are for American Express. So we signed a deal with MasterCard. It was a commercial deal at the time. So then I started to negotiate an equity position for them to invest in KDS. The talk track was, you know, if we suddenly change strategy, you're going to be left vulnerable. So you should have, you should invest, you should have a seat, you should have a say. And it was supposed to be a 25%. In the end, it was like a 5% negotiation. But the threat of American Express's number one competitor taking an equity position in a partner that they relied on heavily in Europe mm-hmm. brought them back to the table. So it was like creating a bit of competitive tension, even though American Express didn't understand that the investment was actually going to be, you know, it wasn't really material. Just the threat of it brought them back to the table. And then what followed was one of the most entertaining negotiations of my life with the then chairman of one half of American Express, which was their travel management business. Like I negotiated the deal with that guy, and it was just insane. It included him having me removed from his offices twice by security.
What you gotta walk us through this. Such a big, it was like a Dame Dash situation.
I'm thinking like champagne bottles is coming in there. How did you get in this office? And so it had to be removed.
It was so funny. I was pretty young too. So what I'm trying to remember what basically happened was after the MasterCard thing, they called and said, actually, we thought about it. You know, we need to have a conversation about acquiring you. Okay. So we all showed up, did the presentation. The company at the time was turning over $35 million. It wasn't 35 million euros. So it wasn't huge. So we do this big presentation. He says, love the company, love what you do. I'm going to make you an offer. But when I make you this offer, the only thing you cannot do is negotiate the offer with me. There's a room full of people. We are not going to negotiate the offer. But you can ask any question you want to ask. And we'd had a great meeting up until this point. So he, you know, writes down a number on the paper, slides it across the table. So I open the paper and it says 6 million euros. Now the company's turning over for 85 million euros. So the offer just doesn't make any sense. It's less than we're paying the developers to develop the software that we're talking about the company acquiring. So I was so stunned when I was like, Greg, this doesn't make any sense. Like, where'd you get 6 million from? He said, see, I told you, don't negotiate the offer. That's it. And he picked up the phone and like just called somebody and security turned up. They said, Mr. Ford, I'm sorry, you got to go. And I was looking at him like in disbelief, is this really? And that was the first time. Then the second time it happened, it was a long way further down the cycle. He calls me, says, listen, I'm going to be in London. I understand we didn't see eye to eye last time. Come up to the office. I'm going to set this straight. So I said to my wife at the time, oh, if he's calling me back, it's a done deal. Like it's going to get done. So I go up to his office. It's just me and him. The office is huge in London. And I arrive and he's super friendly. How's your weekend? How's your family? You like Jay-Z and Beyonce, don't you? I'm like, yeah, I'm a huge fan. He says, oh, they've got the apartment above mine in Manhattan or wherever, or Jersey. I'm going to bring you over. You should meet them. I'm on my boat next week. Like, he's really laying it on. He says, anyway, I realize I offended you last time. I've made you a new offer. So he gives me an offer. It's 12 million euros this time. We've already told him that the clearing number is 100 million euros. Like, he knows this. And I say to him, Greg, this is ridiculous. Like, how could you even imagine this might be possible? And he just starts screaming. He says, you know, you're an idiot. You don't know what a good offer looks like. I can't believe people told me that you're smart, that you know what you're doing. I can't believe you've been running this company. Who's let you run this company? And he calls security again and has me removed. And then, months after that, we get the deal done at 125. But
he still there?
He did the deal.
So how did it go from 6 to 12 to 125? That's not even close to each other.
Well, two things happened. We started a conversation with booking.com and they became aware of that. So again, the competitive tension, actually three things happened. Booking.com happened. Their partner contract with us was coming up for renewal. So I terminated the partner contract. So I said, complete...
we're walking away.
Wouldn't say it was a bluff, but said, you know...
Comfortable not doing this.
We need to renegotiate the terms of this agreement because we don't like them. And we're having other conversations which may affect whether or not we can partner with you. Right? That was the next thing that happened. And then the third thing that happened is I called him and said, I got a board meeting on Friday. And during that board meeting, I'm going to be looking at free offers. And if I accept one of those offers, I won't be able to negotiate with you to potentially acquire the company. So if you want to make me an offer, you have to do it by Friday at 5 o'clock. Okay, bye. And I put the phone down.
No time to respond.
And I had no board meeting on Friday either, by the way. Right. So when I said that to him, and then I was at home on Friday, I remember playing FIFA with my son on Friday. I completely forgot about this conversation. So I'm playing FIFA with my son and I see he's calling my phone. So I'm looking at the phone, I'm thinking, why is he calling me? And then I remembered that I'd played this move of like, you've got until Friday to buy a company. So as soon as I remembered, I'm like, don't answer the phone. So I just let the phone ring. So it keeps ringing, like he's banging the phone at this point. So I turn the TV down. I'm like, Greg, I just stepped out. Like, what's up?
Pause the game.
And he says, you need to not take any offers. I need to speak to you. You need to step out of the meeting right now. I said, look, Greg, if you want to make me an offer, email it to me. I'm in the board meeting right now. I can't talk. And I hung the phone up. And then this like just happened for the next 15 minutes. This kept happening. And then he sent us an offer just under 100. And I said to him, I told him I stepped out of the meeting. I said to him, look, I really want to do this deal with you. I'm really going to try. I don't know if this number quite gets you there, but I'm going to like stop these discussions so that we can progress this, you know, let's take 2 or 3 days, see where we can get it to. We got it to 125.
Brilliant. That's brilliant. So this is the third time you sell.
That was the second. Yeah. Since then, things have been much more.
Let's unpack this before you go to the next topic.
Yeah.
So this is a few valuable lessons for people. And okay, so you had enough courage to balk at two, right? And you also kind of finagled it with making up the story about the boardroom, but then you also brought other people involved, and that's another strategy as far as like, you know, the competition. Nobody wants to feel like they're losing to something else, right? You've done this a few times. So kind of break that down as far as for people that are entrepreneurs of how you have to remain calm under these type of circumstances, because some people might have just, you know, fell to the pressure and did things that they would have really regretted later on.
Yeah. To be honest, I thought about that a lot during that deal cycle. That I grew up in sales, so tense negotiations were kind of familiar to me. I grew up in football where coaches would, you know, become emotional. So that behavior wasn't as threatening to me as someone else. And I grew up in the projects on the housing estate where, you know, for all of his bluster, he was nowhere near as intimidating as people I'd seen. So those things were super helpful to me. What I learned in that process and have since always used when exiting a company is that competitive leverage, competitive tension is, you know, is key. Otherwise, you're sitting opposite somebody trying to tell them that they should just pay more for something because you want more money for something, right? And that's difficult. When you both want to buy my thing and I'm able to say to you that the number you've offered is nice, but it's not nice enough for me to do the deal with you because somebody else is willing to pay more, that puts a very helpful distance between me and you in the negotiation, right? If I'm just saying to you, no, price isn't 100, it has to be 120, that's not as impactful as saying, if you can't get above 120, there's somebody else who will do that deal.
And it's crazy because we just spoke with a sports league. They're in a contract with a major TV network, right? And they were saying that the TV network pretty much told them, like, look, I know that you don't have anybody else that's bidding for this contract, so we really can't negotiate.
Right.
But I know that at some point you probably will have.
Right.
So at that point in time, then you're going to be in a position to actually have a conversation with us. Right. But until then, you have no leverage.
Right.
So it's important for people to know that. Like, you know, it's always good to have somebody else that is bidding for it, because even if they're not going to buy it, at least it raises your interest.
Exactly. In the last process, so with Forterra, where we sold at €1 billion, I did something I never did before, which was we had three parties competing until the moment the deal was signed. Right. So we ran. Normally what you do is you get offers. You say, okay, I like your offer. I'm going to negotiate with you for 30 days to get it done. You have exclusivity for 30 days to get it done. That's what you normally do. In the last process, which was 2022, we said first man to the finish line, you know, gets it. As long as the offers financially were in the right zip code, whoever gets it done first. And that was a new experience for me. Mm. And what that done in the negotiations was something I hadn't seen in my previous three transactions, which was, you know, somebody said, I need this condition in the contract. And it's a completely normal condition. I did it in the previous three deals. It's not something you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But in this situation, I was just like, oh, actually, we don't really want to do that. No, you know, no. Market conditions, deal norms, a lot of them didn't get done because everybody understood that this was a race to the finish line and was highly competitive. So that, like, that changes dynamics in the negotiations when you've got that kind of competitive tension.
Yeah, I think in terms of deals, a lot of times people might have taken the 12 because they haven't done the proper valuation of their actual business.
Right.
Or they might say, we may not get another offer. We'll do it here and we'll try to work up to it. So, like, what's that process for you? Obviously, that was, you wanted the 125.
Mm-hmm.
The next deal is we had $1 billion. How are we figuring out the valuation and how are we negotiating on that?
Mm-hmm. So, good thing about tech is, there's tons of comps and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of formulas that guide you to what the price should be, right? So a company, you know, a company in our space that has over 30% margins, over 70% of the revenue is recurring, that company's valuation will start at 19 times its EBITDA. Like, that's, you know, everybody knows that, and nobody's going to come into the room and try and offer you 15 because, you know, everybody kind of gets that it starts there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's helpful. Then from that 19 times foundation, yeah, it's on you to sell your kind of strategic advantage that you're offering a buyer, the opportunity you're offering the buyer, the return on investment that buyer is going to realize. That bit's on you between 19 and 25 or 30 times EBITDA where the deal gets done. But you get, in tech, you get good.
Yeah.
You know, you get good formulas that give you foundation of value. I think that the main threat to underselling in those situations is people sometimes think, well, they must know better, right? So in our case, we're a tiny company selling to American Express. I think in that situation, it would have been easier for someone to say, these guys must know what the valuation is. They must know better than we do. They buy companies all the time. They're a big company. He's a smart guy. I think that's actually a bigger risk. It was pretty easy for me. I wouldn't have made any money at €12 million. So discussion closed.
Is there a number for the multiple that you look for a sweet spot? Or if it's 19 as a standard, are we figuring out how we add components to the company to get to that 20,
exactly.
25, 30?
Yeah, exactly. 19, like there are in our space. So we're a tech company, ERP, in our space, the things that move the valuation needle are pretty well understood, right? So I used an example a moment ago where you would say 70% of the recurring of the revenue would be recurring. If 70% of your revenue for a company like us is recurring, the valuation is then done on the last 6 months profitability and the next 6 months projected profitability. Because if so much of the revenue is recurring, the next 6 months is very predictable. If 85% of the revenue is recurring, then the valuation is done on the next 12 months, not the last six, the next 12 months, because the markets assume that the revenue and profitability will be pretty well solidified because so much of it is on long-term contracts, right? So one of the things I would try to do if I wanted to get above 19 is I would work hard on making 70% recurring, 80%. Mm-hmm. So these components in tech are pretty well understood.
So, okay. So where does Fortero come into play?
So after KDS and the Amex deal, one of the kind of exciting things about the Amex deal was the chairman with whom I negotiated, once we were doing the deal and we had, you know, we started to sign paperwork, he became very, very friendly. So he talked a lot about what we were going
to
do together.
So talk about that too. All right. So don't take anything personal, right? Because he insulted you on multiple occasions. Mm. That's another lesson. How were you able to not take it personal? And was that weird to kind of still be cordial? Like
in that meeting one-on-one when he was screaming, it took everything in my life's being, you know, not to behave in a certain way. And I remember sitting there just thinking, I just got to get out of the room. The thing I have to do is just get out of the room. And in subsequent conversations, I just had in the back of my mind that I was going to win in this scenario. I said, this game ends when I've won, right? And as things progressed, there were two victories I could see that I could pursue. One was getting the deal done at a great valuation, especially in the manner in which it got done. Like that gave me a lot of personal satisfaction that he bid against himself. Like he talked himself up from 95 to 125. That was beautiful for me. The second thing was that we'd shaken hands that I would work for American Express for 3 years afterwards. And I'd always say to him, he'd always say, I'm going to send you the contract. I've sent you a contract. We should talk about it. So don't worry about it. Like we'll talk about it later. Like we'll figure it out later. We've got tons of other stuff to deal with. So I never signed the contract that would have committed me to working there. So the day the money cleared, I never went back to American Express. I just didn't. I didn't go back. So that those two things were my victory that I just walked away.
Okay. So Fortero.
Hmm. Yeah, after KDS, I went to run an Irish tech company, which we sold to Access, which is the UK's largest privately held tech company.
And you start in the UK, then you go to France, mm. then you go to Ireland.
Yep.
So I got to ask you this question. It's the elephant in the room here. when does racism come into play here? Because Europe has been a notorious racist continent for a very long period of time. Everybody knows the history. This is a unique situation, a black person whose parents are immigrants running companies in white countries that we have no representation of black. Mm-hmm. You think of Ireland, you're not thinking of black people. France, like I said, everybody knows the history. UK has a terrible history across the world mm-hmm. when it comes to racism and colonization. How is this happening?
In a sector that I don't even want to use underrepresented.
Yeah.
Very scarce.
Yeah. You know, I only have one recollection of a room I was sat in where I was like, oh, okay, this is racism. Like what's happening right now is racism. I've had tons of situations where I think, it doesn't feel right. Like this is, but I couldn't say to you, like with my hand on my heart, that is the reason this person is behaving poorly. I've had tons of those moments. But the truth of the matter is, I think my mind was so focused on the next thing, I wasn't really paying any attention to it. So when people behave poorly, I was just like, okay, well, how do we get around you? How do we get over you? How do we get to the point you can't affect the thing that I need to get to? So it's possible that I experienced tons of racism, but I just didn't slow down long enough to realize it was happening. And that's my experience. I know tons of other people have very different experiences, and I know a lot of those people, but I can't give you, you know, a set of circumstances where I was clear that was happening to me. Yeah. Only one.
I know we're going to go to Fortel, but I'm thinking, right, when, especially with companies here in America, especially when it's a black CEO and they sell a company, and there's a stigma that comes with it. We've sold out. We've done a disservice to the community. In tech, we haven't seen it as much. Was there any feedback as you're selling companies? Are people aware that black CEO sells company?
I think it's different.
Yeah, though. I'm saying from his perspective.
He's taking over. I think we're looking at it from consumer goods in America.
It changes because it's tech.
It's like a Robert. Nobody's ever criticizing Robert Smith for
selling a tech company.
And he's taking over companies. Yeah. It's not like he's starting a company from the beginning.
Right.
True. But this, I mean, you're selling them, right? Is there any feedback towards that process? Or are people even aware that it's happened?
I think to your point, there's a few things that help insulate you from that. One, there's external investment in the company. So if it's an entrepreneur, a founding entrepreneur, especially consumer goods, who sells that company, and they're a big...
following.
They're a big employer in a community.
Right.
That's where you get some of that. When Vista, Robert...
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
Smith's company is invested. As soon as they invest into a company, everybody knows at some point in time that company is going to get sold. So that helps you. And my track record helps me. When I show up, people go, okay, we know that this is a 5-year, 7-year, 10-year. So yeah, it helps. It helps. In our community, there's an expectation. So if when people in our community understand that you sold, and when they understand that you made money, then the conversation quickly becomes, if you made 10, you know, 50 of that needs to come back and be visible to help us all in some way, shape or form. So that's more the thing you kind of have to deal with when you're doing
it's
exits.
Like, what do you have the money now? What?
Yeah, and nobody knows how much money you have. They just decide for themselves how much money you have, and they decide for themselves how much money you have, and they decide for themselves how much money you should, you know, play back, and they decide where exactly that money should go back to.
Yeah, know all about it. So, all right, I cut you off a few times, but let's get to this Fortel story. So you go to
Access. So we Ireland. sold out. So we at Core HR in Ireland, which Access bought, incredible company run by an incredible CEO, Chris Bain, and we were wondering if I could be his successor. What I learned at Access was it's a much bigger company than Core HR and KDS was. So I learned what it's like to run a big, much bigger software company, because I was president of Access for a while working with Chris. And I learned one thing, which was how to operate at that scale, because that was the first time I'd really operated at that scale. And the other thing I learned is that I was a lousy number two, right, to Chris. So he was the CEO, and I just didn't enjoy being a number two. And it took me a while to say that out loud, because it's like, well, what is it? Is it ego? Is it, you know, what? Why can't you just, it's a great company, you got a great role, you're well compensated. But in the end, I was just like, yeah, I'm just not enjoying being a number two. And the chairman of Core HR called me and said, I know the investors at Fortero, they're looking for a CEO. I think you'd be great. I've told them that you might look at it. And he teed it up, because we'd worked together effectively at Core HR. He teed it up at Fortero. I met the investors. We didn't really interview. We just talked a lot about the company, and then boom.
He became CEO. What exactly is Fortero? Like, what does the company do?
We make technology. We make software that manufacturers run their production lines and their accounting and financials. So it's right at the core of how they run and operate their business.
And that position, that's when you acquired, you had 17 acquisitions.
By the time I got there, the company had done 8. And then in the first 2 years, we did 9 more. So in total, the company's done 17 acquisitions. Okay. But I've only been there
you've done 9.
For 9.
Yeah. And then you did 2 prior.
Yeah, right.
And how those nine that you acquired, you sold all nine of those?
No. So now Forterra's is
holding company?
A group structure. We're now unifying it into a single company. But it's like 17 acquired businesses that we're now moving into one.
So you haven't sold any of those companies?
No. Yeah. No.
So like when you, now that you acquired those, you sold, you had the $1 billion valuation. As you acquire more assets, now we're starting to see the valuation
right
climb as you add more.
Right.
Is that the goal to push the valuation to a certain number?
Yeah, so we did the deal. So Battery Ventures, who brought me on as CEO, we exited Battery Ventures by bringing in Partners Group, so you know, another much bigger private equity firm, and they acquired the company at a billion euros. So when I went as CEO, normal thing happens, you get equity, and I invested my own money too. So when that deal happened, I reinvested behind Partners Group at the billion euro valuation. And now the plan is to scale to 4 billion. We're 2 years in, and we should cross the 2 billion mark in valuation in September this year.
So it sold for $1 billion.
Correct.
Yep. But the money was reinvested into the company.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
And now you're seeking a 2 billion, essentially 4 billion valuation.
Yeah, we're climbing through 2 billion, should be September, and then hopefully another 2 to 3 years.
What was the process of the, that's what I remember. They said that you were the only, how many black CEOs had achieved unicorn status in the UK?
At the time, Bloomberg said 7 of privately held, I think it was in Europe, of privately held companies with billion euro or more, 7.
So what was the process of actually selling the $1 billion valuation and then the restructure and then moving the company forward to where it's headed now?
So most of the time I spent with Dave when I was joining was on how we were going to get him a good exit, right? Because he'd been an investor in Forterra for 12 years at that point. And I knew the now investor from before. So, you know, the power of, you know, your network and your previous relationships, we kind of brought them to the table and then we brought some others to the table. And that drove the number to €1 billion. But we were really pitching the opportunity to get to 4 billion. That's what we talked to Partners Group and the other parties who bid on the company. We said, this is an opportunity to invest in something that will become a 4 billion euro software company. And in Europe, like there aren't many software companies at that scale on the private markets in our sector. So that's why we had so much interest. It was a good strategy. I guess, you know, I had a good track record of delivering outcomes for private investors, and we had a good plan to get to 4 billion, and that's kind of how we got everybody to the table.
You've made the transition from athlete to businessman. I wonder now, as you look back, and even how your peers who used to be footballers with, we know in that space, it's a short-term career. Mm. There's only going to be 5 to 10 years where you're going to be great, and hopefully you can make as much as you can during that time frame. Whereas you're doing something that is sustainable. How does that relationship now with your former peers, or are they still your peers, and how are they viewing you at this point?
I love it. I love it because at the beginning of my career, like when they were all thriving, I found that very difficult. I was happy for them, right? Really happy for them. And a lot of them are still, I'm still very close to a lot of them. So it was great to see them thrive, play for their country, you know, play in the Premier League. It was brilliant. But for me, it was hard and I was just starting my career. Now, their earning potential has peaked, and you know, and they've done well. It's not about money, but my, you know, I'm just kind of finding my stride now, right? The next 10 years could be better than the last 10 years for me from a career perspective. So sometimes, like, that's a good joke that we have amongst us, that they're like, I, you know, tell them all the time they're old and washed up and nobody cares about you anymore, but like, I'm just hitting my stride. So that's a bit of a funny exchange that we have.
So let me ask you this. As far as the face of mergers and acquisitions currently, right? I know there's rising cost of debt. So how has that affected you guys' strategy?
It hasn't. I mean, it definitely changes the way we look at things, because before we could buy a business for 100 million euros. We could do that all with debt. That debt might cost us 5 million euros. That company we buy might be, you know, making 5 million of profit. So from a cash perspective, completely neutral on the company. You just bought an asset for 100 million. your valuation has gone up as a result, and there's no negative cash impact on the company. Now that same deal might cost you 12 million a year in debt, and that company is still only making 5 million euros. So there's a net 7 million cash out position for us. So in terms of strategy, it doesn't change, but the economic engineering of those deals changes a lot. To give you an example, that, you know, that example I just gave you, we would now have to be much more aggressive in making that company able to cover the cost of the debt when we acquire it. So we would be more aggressive in taking cost out, for example, or trying to accelerate the top line. Whereas 3 years ago, we might be able to be a bit more thoughtful, a bit more strategic, and a bit more patient.
So you say that the debt, you could do $100 million in pretty much borrowed money. Where is this coming from? Banks? Is it coming from hedge funds? Is it coming from, like, where would that money come from as far as from you?
Banks. Yeah, we have a good, and it's pretty common in our space, you have a good network of banks. You have a set of what we would call debt relationships. You find an asset you want to buy. You got a good track record of buying companies and creating value. You can get good terms on the debt. And that's exactly how we would fund our, you know, our acquisitions. Because our growth and our profitability are what drives the 19 times valuation.
Oh, yeah.
If I've got debt, we just net it out at the end of the transaction. It's a billion euro valuation. Oh, you have 200 million of debt? Okay. Now it's 800 million of equity value. Nobody bats an eyelid at it. If I don't have profitability because I'm servicing debt with cash, then there's a smaller thing to multiply by 19 and it brings the company valuation down. So we're much better off financing acquisitions with debt than with cash out of the company.
Race hasn't been as much of a challenge. It doesn't seem like debt is a challenge. What are the biggest challenges that you face during this process of mergers and acquisitions?
Well, race, I've experienced cultural disharmony more than I would say, you know, direct race. So when you're a young black guy trying to buy a company from a old white Italian, there's a longer journey to walk to, you know, to get on the same page, to have him become comfortable that he's gonna sell his life's work to you, right? Those deals often happen when me and you find a good rhythm, a good alignment. We eat together, we spend time together. I get you comfortable that I'm the right person to continue the legacy you've created. You're going to sell me your company. You want to know I'm going to treat your employees well, your customers well. It just takes longer to get that cultural alignment when you're me trying to do that across Europe. So that I notice and see that more. The other big challenge is talent, like getting and keeping good people. Because of the economy, people are just staying in jobs longer. And it's average people that stay in jobs longer. Like the top people can find an opportunity to move. So average people stay for longer. And that can be problematic. And now you're trying to wrench a top performer out of another company. And that company knows that that's their top performer. So that person's incredibly well compensated. They're incredibly well looked after. So it makes it harder to get top performers, and average people just stay for longer.
So when you're actually looking for a company to acquire, what are you looking for?
We're looking for things that are we kind of have a playbook, right? So we're looking for things which are serving the same types of customer that we already have. We're looking for things which are adjacent technologies. So we have, our suite of enterprise resource planning applications. We're looking for things that we can bolt on or add to that. Or we're looking for things in new geographies. So we're not in Italy at the moment. So can we find something that gives us a platform or a first entrant into the Italian market? But it has to be within that sphere of what we're, what we're currently doing. We don't want to step too far outside of this, what we call our aperture.
So in the world of technology, especially in the business that you have with analytics and making things more efficient, over the past 2 to 3 years, how has AI adjusted to the game plan? Like, what adaptations have you had to make, if any?
Well, the first, it took us a while to figure out that in considering AI, we had to divide our brain. There's one brain looking at how AI will enable internal efficiencies, right? How can we aim AI at ourselves to make us more effective, more efficient, and as a consequence, more profitable? Then there's how do we aim AI at our customers to help them become? And it's two very different thought processes. So that took us a long time to kind of figure out that dividing the thought process would be helpful. Internally, we've done a lot of good things that automate, you know, automate processes like customer support, for example. You know, we've been able to train AI to answer most frequently asked questions. So now we deflect a lot of support inquiries. They don't need a human being to address that. AI can take care of that. On the customer side, it's a little bit more difficult because remember, we're acquiring businesses. So we have 17 different product lines with 17 different data models. So in order to get the best from AI, you need AI to, you know, you need to aim AI at a consistent like data setup. But we have 17 different, and that's making it a little bit harder to figure out the AI, the external AI strategy. But it's a huge, it will be a huge advantage for us once we get our heads around it.
So you have teams in 11 different countries with the companies that you represent?
No more. We have teams in about 16.
16? 16. So how does that work as far as you have a CEO for each one of those companies? You're like the head of the operations. You check in with them periodically. Do they speak different languages? How does this work?
Yeah, historically we had 15, 16 CEOs, but as I mentioned before, we're unifying the company. So now we're structured what we call functionally. So I'm the CEO, there's a head of sales, and that head of sales is responsible for all of the sales teams in all 16, 17 different product lines. There's a head of marketing. That head of marketing is responsible for all of the marketing across all of the product lines. So we're moving from the structure that you described where each product has its own set of functions to a unified set of functions.
So you're the head of all of it?
Yeah.
So, all right. So how does that work? When dealing with different languages, different cultures, mm-hmm. different... How are you able to delegate authority effectively to 16 different satellites?
I've been doing that since Primavera. Like when I was, you know, employee 6 at Primavera and we grew internationally, I was hiring people in Japan. I was hiring people in China. And I was pretty young. So one of the advantages I gained is I was able to spend, I could stay in China for 4 weeks. I didn't have kids. I wasn't married. So I would stay there and I would become attuned to the culture in ways that, you know, people who didn't have that opportunity weren't. So I'm probably quite culturally sensitive because of that, but I don't speak any other languages. So my senior leadership team all speak very good English, and then they have their second, sometimes third language. But business is pretty international now. Like it's not, you know, it hasn't been a major
issue
for me. No.
And what countries do you have presence in with these countries?
My biggest Germany, France, Spain, huge center in India, huge center in Bulgaria, big center in Morocco, a little bit here in the US. So we're everywhere.
In terms of impact, you said that, you know, when you actually have a sale, people understand that, yes, you've made money, and the automatic thing is like, oh, this is how you have to give it back. And I'm thinking community when you say that. But in terms of the space, the sector, are you seeing people, are you coming into the space, or are you still the guide? And it's like, when are the crowds going to come? When are people going to take interest? When are they going to have an idea that this is the opportune way to expand your career?
People of color coming into space? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and there's a ton of great networks who are really driving that agenda in a fantastic way. You got Black Tech Awards, you got BYP in the UK. So there are a handful of organizations who are really, really driving that agenda. And there's tons, like I get hundreds of messages a week from young Black people trying to get into tech or early in tech. We just had an event through our, you know, my foundation, 300 people, most of them in or around tech-enabled services. So, yeah, it's brilliant to see the energy from the Black community coming into tech.
So what's your advice for companies that want to get to a level where they could potentially be purchased by somebody like you, right? Like, what should a founder be working on the early levels as far as implementing systems? Because sometimes it's hard to kind of reverse the engineer after it's already 3 years down the line. You've made systematic mistakes that's kind of hard to, like, what should they be thinking about at day one with the plan in 5 years? I'm gonna be trying to sell my company.
Two things I learned which have really helped me. So one is team, especially for founders, because one of the most value crippling scenarios that I see founders walk into time and time again is maintaining ownership, not just equity ownership, but ownership of each function, everything that needs to be done. It's their thing, so they keep hold of it. They don't let others who have experience, expertise, relationships in easily. And by the time I show up, there's some parts of the company that are performing well below the level they should be, just because the founder hasn't got the experience or the time to service those areas well. So get people in who are brilliant on topics, narrow and deep, right? That's the first thing. Second thing I learned is to start to manage your company in the way that your target acquirer might manage your company. So for me, in software, I look at something called the rule of. That's the percentage of profit the company makes plus the rate at which it grows. And that's a starting indicator for health of a software company. If a software company grows at 50% and break even, that's okay. That's a rule of 50. If a software company grows at 50% and makes 10% margins, that's a rule of 60. That company is better than the one that grows. It's a starting indicator, so that rules. That company is better than the other one. If it grows at 25% but makes a 10% loss, that's now a rule of 15 company, right? So think about that rule of. Then there's something like a CAC, customer acquisition cost. That's where you take the total cost, sales cost, marketing cost, any cost you have to acquire a customer, and you put it up against the amount of sales that you made, and that gives you your customer acquisition cost. And that cost should be as low as possible. That says that the sales and marketing engine is highly performant. So in our space, there will be six or seven of those things that are long distance indicators for the health of a company. And when I sit with a founder or entrepreneur in an acquisition conversation and they sit down and say, my CAC is €1.10 now, it was €1.25 last year, and I think I can get it to 99, I almost stop thinking about whether that number is good or bad. I just now know that this company sells a marketing engine is run in a way that is highly considerate of optimizing the CAC. That's a brilliant thing, right? That means that the company thinks about it, they calculate it, they know what they spend on. That's a very comforting thing. So when I've been building companies, I start to understand what the ultimate acquirer is going to be interested in and start to manage my company, you know, using terms, languages, and KPIs that ultimately they're going to measure me on.
So you're starting with the end.
Yeah. I literally that was going to be my next question. So that's just how they prepare for it. But that literally sounds like what you're doing when you're looking to acquire.
Looking
at every one of these metrics.
I look at what I acquire in that way, and I run my company. Because I know what questions people are going to ask me when I'm selling. I know what things they're going to look at. Yeah. But the thing not to mistake that for is to run your company to be bought. You mustn't do that either, because you know you can have a relationship with American Express. You can think this is the most natural buy on earth. This is a no-brainer of a deal, and then the thing can go the way like it was going with me. So you can't run the company to be sold, but you should run it, you know, using the metrics, the language, the standards of excellence that potential acquirers are going to be interested in.
So, all right. So using that framework, and your plan is to sell this company at $4 billion, right?
Yeah.
You want to sell it at $4 billion. It's over.
Yeah. Well, we have to define over, because it could be bought by a new investor who has a plan to get it to $8 billion valuation, or it could be bought by an Oracle.
The exit is $4
billion. The exit is $4 billion, correct.
What are you doing? So, what are you doing to prepare for that $4 billion exit?
Lots. Look, I think we bought the first nine companies in 12 years. We bought the next nine companies in just over 2 years. I think in the next 2 years, we'll probably buy another 15.
But even like structurally, right? Like when you have made the analogy of like, if you're looking to like do what you know that somebody is going to buy your company is going to do, right? So like what, like are there systems in place that you're purposely putting in place because you know that this is going to be appealing when we get to this point? Oh,
okay. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So two examples. One is I mentioned before that we have kind of 17 companies with 17 different products and 17 different data sets. We've got a big tech platform investment that we're making. It's a multi-million euro every year investment to put a harmonized platform across all 14. The quickest way to describe the reason to do that is so when I want to acquire things that I can sell to all 17 customers, right? And what I don't want to have to do is acquire something and go and walk the streets in all 17 countries to sell it. Can I buy something integrated to this tech platform that all 17 products are part of? And suddenly, you know, the day after the acquisition, all of the customers of all 17 products have access to a new product that they might pay me for, or well, that they will pay me for. That's something we can't do today because everything is siloed. So that's one example. Another example is improving the profitability of the company by unifying it. Simple example of that is I have 17 relationships with laptop providers. Each company negotiates its IT procurement itself. If I go to Dell and say I buy 1,000 laptops a year for new starters, I'll get a better price than this company who's buying 50, this company who's buying 25. So the company can use its scale to improve its purchasing power and buy things for less, and as a consequence the profitability of the company improves.
This sounds like a semiconductor where it's like I create the chip, all these companies will need it, I can sell it to each one of them.
Right.
So when you get to this point, I like the exit, like you said, it's $4 billion. Does the equity structure change for you every time you do the deal, or is it strictly the same? Like I'm going to keep this amount of equity no matter what the exit is?
In what sense?
So let's say there was a 7% equity stake in the umbrella company. If it gets reinvested, if the company gets sold at the $8 billion valuation, do you restructure that or does it stay at the 7%? How does that work?
Normally, as the company scales, the percentage goes down. Mm-hmm. Like that's an unfortunate, it's an unfortunate market trend I haven't been able to change yet. Normally what happens is, you know, if you are what we call go forward management, the new investor wants to see you leave as much money in the company as possible. So if your 7% is worth 100 million, they don't want you to take 100 million off the table and then give you another 7%. Because if you're telling them that this can go from 1 billion to 4 billion, they're kind of saying, well, why would you want to take a penny of your money out now? So they like to see you leave a lot of money in. What I've done is I always leave my money in and I always try to put more money in and use that as a way to negotiate up what might be the 7% you're going to give me. I say, well, look, I'm leaving everything in. I'm putting even more money in. Now I'm super invested. This is why you should incentivize me even further because of how invested I am in this.
So what do you think makes an effective CEO in today's landscape?
The thing I've found hardest and most impactful or most accelerating when I do it well, which I don't do as often as I should, is communication. Is communication, and especially in our context, as you described, right? There's languages, there's cultures, there's time zones. I was working for this 100-person German company, and I'm now part of a 3,000 person multinational company. Like I never traveled out of my office before. I never spoke to anybody who wasn't German before, but suddenly now I'm in this. So being able to communicate effectively, motivate effectively, correct effectively thousands of people across multiple countries, multiple cultures, multiple experience frames is the number one accelerant to performance in our company.
Is that the most unique trait that has led to success for you? Right, because when you're talking about, you have to show somebody who's selling their company that you're the best person.
Mm.
So there's something unique about what you're doing. Is it the communication, or is there something that a gift that you have just been given with that is like, I'm that guy to do this?
There's two things. I don't know that I'm brilliant at anything. I am extremely resilient. Like, life has made me, you know, very, very resilient. So I'm, against my peers and other people I see, I'm more able to wake up tomorrow after a terrible today and get right back at it, like, quicker than most, you know, most other people. And I think that's had a positive drag on the company too. Bad things happen in business, bad things happen in the company. So when my team or my organization know that today was bad and they see me bounce back tomorrow and say, okay, you know, it's going to be fine, let's go again, I think I've been able to get us out of the down moments pretty quickly. So I think that's one thing. And the other thing I try very hard to do is translate the aspiration of the company into something that's meaningful for employees, right? Because I just don't fundamentally believe that employees come to work for the company. That unless, yeah, maybe, well, people like Google and Facebook a few years ago, that was the tone, that, you know, people were so proud that they worked for Google and Facebook. That's not really the case at Fortera. Like, me explaining to 3,000 people, come to work because we're trying to be a 4 billion euro company. Like, nobody leaves their kids in the morning to come to do that, especially when they don't have, you know, they don't have to gain what I have to gain. So what I've tried hard to do is figure out how to talk about the fact we do need to become a 4 billion euro company in a way that you will care about and will make you motivated and excited to come to work. And I spend a lot of time on adjusting the message or adjusting what I'm going to say or write or present, so that it lands on employees like that.
So how do you look at other asset classes, whether it's for business or your own personal investing, like real estate or stocks or crypto? Like, you know, do you indulge in that, or what's your thoughts on those other asset classes?
So personally, I only invest in things I know and understand. I always say that, right? So I know tech. So most of my investments are in tech. I know property. Most of my investments in property. And then there's like a small handful of things I did because I was curious or I liked the person. I'm invested in a champagne brand because I'm just, you know, that would be cool. So there's a small handful of those things, but tech and property. I didn't do the crypto thing at all. I still don't really understand crypto.
So property, like, talk about that. What's your philosophy on now? Are you buying houses or commercial real estate? Like, what's your...
So what I did for a long time was, just as we were getting cash, my wife and I were getting cash, we owned every house we lived in, and we've continued to own every house we ever lived in. So that was one way. And then as we saw deals opportunistically, we bought places and we rent them out. And we were quite liquid buyers, so we were able to get good, you know, good deals because we would close quickly. So that is one strategy. Now, you know, my two best friends are developers. So they're always out finding properties to buy and, you know, adding a lot of value through doing development. So I'm a passive cash investor alongside them. Like, they really know what they're doing. So I'm just a cash investor there.
Does your wife work inside the business?
She works in the foundation. So we've set up a foundation, that's the vehicle through which we do our community work, you know, back in the community. She runs that.
What I'm thinking is, like, everybody talks about generational wealth and, you know, having a family as part of that, right? Creating sustainability. But when you talk about financial freedom, I wonder for you, is it a number or is it a mindset more so at this level?
It's not a number because, how do I explain this? Like, my life now is well beyond the wildest of my wildest dream growing up. So to sit here and say, you know, the number at which life would be good would be is like ridiculous. It would be such a ridiculous thing for someone like me to say, coming from where I come from. Mm-hmm. I'm still competing with myself And the prize in the sport I'm in is it happens to be money. Like it happens to be exits which attract money. So I'm still trying to see, can I do a four bit? Can I build a company to four bit? Like that would be pretty cool to do that. And with that comes money. When I think about my life after working, I just think about time. Like just having, 'cause the thing I don't have at the moment, I don't have any time at the moment. So I don't look forward to money or luxury. I just look forward to waking up in the morning and thinking, I might walk my dogs for 2 hours instead of one. Like that is the thing I'm ultimately trying to attain, just getting back total time and freedom. I think that's what wealth is, time and choice. That to me is what wealth really is.
So before we leave, talk about your foundation. Like what are you guys doing? What does that consist of? And what's the vision for that?
The foundation is called Forbes Family Group. Sorry. So our foundation is the Forbes Family Group. And what my wife and I realized is as our life was changing, we had this incredible network that we built up, or, you know, that I'd built up as my career was developing. And we were just scratching our heads saying, how do we put this network to good use? And we tried a couple of different ways at the beginning that didn't quite work, weren't scalable, weren't received in the way that we intended. But now the foundation is about, connections. It's about community. It's about capital. So it's about using the network to connect young aspiring entrepreneurs or young professionals to people who can help them on their entrepreneurial or business journey, professional journey. It's about capital. So we've got a lot of friends who are investors, private equity friends, venture capital friends. So we're dragging them back to say there are good businesses in the community. There are good businesses, good entrepreneurs we know, invest. And we'll invest alongside you because, you know, we get incredibly underinvested as a people. So we're doing that. And then there are a couple of charities which are very close to us personally. One is Power the Fight, which is an anti-knife crime charity. And the other is the Africa Caribbean Leukemia Trust. Very, you know, we're very attached to those personally because we're always getting dragged into philanthropy conversations. We said instead of doing 20 things for 20 different charities, everything we do is for these two. And that's what we use the foundation for, the community, the connections, and capital.
Well, it's been a pleasure, my brother. Anything else that you want to discuss before we let you go?
So there's a friend of mine who started a champagne brand it originates in Africa. It's finished in the UK. But the spirit of it is he opened up that brand to me to invest in. Like it was already, he'd already raised money. He already had product, he was already going to market. And I said to him, oh, you know, I wouldn't mind being part of this. He was like, if you want to be part of it, I'll make way for you to be part of it. And I think it's just a good story of sometimes we don't see enough among us. Mm-hmm. Just making way for us both to do something together. Like he didn't need me. He's very well known in the culture. He's got a lot of connectivity. He had this business going. But when I said I wanted to be part of it, he was like very, very accommodating. And now it's doing really, really well. But just that openness to say, yeah, let's make room. Like let's make there be a seat at the table so you can be part of it. I guess we just did it. It's called Severin.
What's the name of it?
Severin.
Severin?
Severin. Severin.
Yeah. All right, that's what we'll be sipping on.
There you have it. Moguls Edition. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming to America. I know you got a few other things that you'll be doing while you're stateside. So next time we're in London, we got to connect.
Absolutely.
We shall have dinner.
We'll be coming soon, June probably.
We'll have dinner. We'll have Severin on the table.
Uh-huh.
And we'll just make the table a little bit bigger.
There you go. That's it. That's yeah, the move.
For sure. Well, I appreciate it. Keep up the great work and let's stay in touch. When you hit that 4 billion mark, let's do a follow-up.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you guys for rocking with us. We'll see you next week. Peace.
Peace.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.